This is the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Philip Drew, Administrator. My guest is David J. Thoreau. He is the founder and president of the Independent Institute in Oakland. He's the publisher of the Independent Review. He has won numerous awards for Best Book. He was the founding vice president of the Cato Institute and founding president of the Pacific Research Institute for Public Policy. He's got a new book called Freedom on Film and has presided over the publishing of over 70 books. Welcome, Mr. Thoreau.
Hi, how are you?
Doing just fine.
Great.
What's the deal, Independent Institute? Tell me all about it.
Well, Independent Institute is a public policy research institute, or a think tank, if you will. We're an academic research institute. We produce lots of books. As you mentioned, we produce a journal called the Independent Review. We organize lots of conference and media projects. There are a lot of groups that are involved in public policy debate in the U.S. and elsewhere. The approach that we take is that we are not impressed or interested in plain politics. Our interest is to look at major issues that exist in society, whether it's the problems in education or healthcare or crime or war and peace or any issue, and try to determine a more exacting assessment of the effects of government policy. And with that, we aim to redefine or redirect debate in mainstream society, whether it's the media or the academic world or the general public. And so our results tend to be provocative and timely and hopefully constructive.
Very good. And I got to tell you, I found you guys from antiwar.com has a link to the Center on Peace and Liberty.
Right.
And that's how I stumbled across you guys.
Okay. That's one of our centers that we operate, which focuses on the relationship of war to tyranny, both the effects of government intervention in other countries, in our case, U.S. policy in other countries, and also the effect domestically. There's an old saying by a journalist in World War I whose name was Randolph Bourne, and his saying was, "War is the health of the state," that war is the major engine for government to acquire power in many different aspects of life, economic aspects, civil liberties aspects.
And that's bad?
That is bad, yes. And what happens is that politicians will declare a crisis, usually a war crisis, and the crisis is used as a rationale to disband the normal constraints on government power, which might be constitutional constraints. And as a result, new government programs are started, new taxes, normal procedures of the rule of law are disregarded, and this gives an opportunity for interest groups to make hay in getting government to do essentially special favors for them that normally they could not get past. And then after this crisis, real or imagined, passes, government programs never go back to their previous level. They essentially create a new threshold, and then with each subsequent crisis, you build to the next threshold. And so war is a very convenient means to socialize a society, to create all sorts of pork and corporate welfare and trampling on the Bill of Rights. And in the aftermath of 9/11, we've seen this all over the place, whether it's the effects domestically, such as protectionism, record farm bill, record spending on education, and all sorts of different measures, as well as measures such as the USA Patriot Act and other measures that are essentially obliterating different parts of the Bill of Rights, as well as enamoring people to the idea of the U.S. just sort of intervening unilaterally in other countries. Certainly, if other countries had this view and intervened in the United States, people would not be very pleased. And hence, the direction that the government has been taking since 9/11 is not exactly one that's conducive to expanding or protecting people's freedoms or security.
I was going to ask you this later on, but since we're in the middle of this discussion now, I was going to ask you what you think about William Safire. I noticed he was one of the first ones to write about how Bush needed to take that 9/11 momentum and go right into Iraq, and is one of the big promoters of war, and yet at the same time, in his column in the New York Times, he often writes about, I think he's the one who broke the story about the total information awareness and complaining all about the new federal police state. And I just wonder what you think about him taking both those stands together.
Well, I think the columns that he's done critiquing the domestic attack that John Ashcroft, who's Attorney General, and other people in the Bush administration on the Bill of Rights is admirable, and it's been extremely helpful. Safire, as you may recall, became prominent as a speechwriter for Richard Nixon. And I think he learned certain things from the Watergate experience. On the other hand, Safire is also an unrepentant advocate of U.S. intervention, especially related to Israel. And even with the fact that there is no evidence now of any weapons of mass destruction that can be found in Iraq, or at least if they do find some weapons of mass destruction, some traces of biological chemical weapons, the fact of the matter is that Saddam Hussein did not use them even when his regime was about to fall. So the whole case that was made by people such as Safire that the U.S. should intervene in Iraq because there was a dire threat to Americans or to Israel, for that matter, is preposterous. And yet he continues to maintain this position. And so I think that is not a good comment on his perspective on these kinds of matters.
I wonder, because he doesn't seem like a very dull wit, and I just
he's not a dull wit. He's a very smart man. He's a brilliant brilliant writer. He's an expert on the English language, but he has this blind spot, and he's one of the major neoconservative journalists. And he has a very decided loyalty to the state of Israel, and I think that colors his ability to be rational about these matters.
Good point. And now I learned in searching around on the internet that besides the Center on Peace and Liberty, you guys have a Center on Entrepreneurial Economics, a Center on Health and the Environment, a Center on Education, and I think I want to hear about those.
Well, all these different centers are focusing on different important areas of public policy. And we as an organization were started about 17 years ago or so. And in the course of that, we've produced books and different studies, and we've held many events and so on and so forth on issues, say, pertaining to healthcare. And what we decided to do was simply to integrate that into these individual centers, where we can then hopefully magnify the effect of the work and further advance the quality of the analysis. And the purpose of what we do is not to have a bunch of scholars sitting around talking to each other. The idea is to do work that can hold up any kind of scrutiny that then can be used to hopefully, as I mentioned, redefine and redirect public debate and win the battle of ideas. I mean, that's the whole idea. And so whether it's on environmental issues or issues of the law or whatever, the same thing holds. And so each of these topics, education and so forth, it opens up a whole discussion in itself.
So is there an official position on these issues, or you're just trying to have a forum for the best kind of debate about?
Well, the Institute itself doesn't take positions on issues. What we do is that we sponsor studies, and the studies are intended to be not concerned about the political expediency or trendiness or partisanship of particular policies. As a result, there's no issue we might not look at, and there's no area of government policy we might critically not examine. what we do find is that over and over again you have a recurring story. You find that ex-public bureaucracy not only seems to be causing more problems than it's solving, but it seems to be hurting the people it's supposed to be helping. In other words, it's actually a predatory way of conducting affairs. Now, obviously, that's not what people want. So if this is true, then we need to rethink what's going on. And so that's what we look into. And
can you give us some examples on that in terms of healthcare, environment, education? I think those are issues that primarily liberals tend to pretend that they have the upper hand on because they're for more government involvement in those things. And I kind of like to hear a different point of view for a change, if I could.
Okay, let's take the environment, for example. The usual view is that people on their own making their own choices and through business firms who produce goods and services, that because those decisions are made for self-serving purposes, that the broader good of society is not taken into consideration. Therefore, business firms will likely pollute rivers and the air and produce products that are shoddy and so on and so forth. The problem though with this, this thesis is that it is partly true. However, it leaves out an important component, which I'll get to in a second. The conclusion that's drawn by most people interested in environmental problems is that the solution is to have a government entity which takes into consideration all of society, which then steps in and stops this greedy behavior, the self-serving behavior, so that people are not harmed by it. So you don't have polluted lakes and rivers and air and all the rest of it, okay? The problem with the analysis that's left out is what's called the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons is a term that describes a problem that is caused by things in the world are held in common. In other words, you don't own them. They're owned, we own them together.
Like the air.
Like the air, like a river, like the roads, like the parks. It's called collective ownership, so to speak. And what happens is that when you have things held in common, no one is responsible for it, and no one has incentive to take care of it. The classic example of this is a village that has a hillside where everybody grazes their sheep, and everybody owns the hillside together. So different people have their sheep herds, and they're grazing their herds on the hillside, and because there's a limited number of blades of grass on the hillside, eventually you overgraze the hillside. Why? Because no individual sheep herder has an incentive to replant the grass, because if he or she were to take the time and devote resources to replant grass on the hillside, everyone would benefit, although everyone else would not have expended costs for it. So since he's competing with all these other sheep herders, he is out where everybody else benefits if he replants. So the tendency is that no one has an incentive to replant. So historically what happens is that people would then move to another hillside, and they'd overgraze that, and they go to another hillside. Eventually you run out of hillsides, because everything is limited in the world. Everything is what economists call scarce. So historically, two things happened. One was the invention of agriculture. And the invention of agriculture meant that you had a property right to the land and to the basically what you were growing or preserving. So if you have a cornfield and you're growing corn, you know that when you pick the corn and when you plant the corn, the corn will be there when it's ready to be harvested without your neighbor sending their cattle through or their sheep through to eat it. The other invention historically was the invention of bureaucracy. Bureaucracy was the pharaoh has this group of people who are there responsible for managing, say, the Nile River Valley. And they are funded by taxes. So on the one hand, agriculture was the idea that people would own the land, they would then grow their crops and sell them to willing customers. On the other hand, you had this bureaucracy that would set down rules and regulations and taxes on people that either they complied or off of their head. In the instance of the bureaucracy, the problem that would occur is that the people who would run these bureaucracies wanted to advance themselves. They could not sell more products because all their revenues were received by taxes. So how would they benefit themselves? Well, the only way they could benefit themselves is to have a larger bureaucracy, a larger agency with more money, more power, more staff. And the only way you can get that, when you go every year to the Pharaoh to get renewal of your budget, is to show that the problems on this commons still exist or are getting worse. So you have a disincentive to solve the problems on this hillside, this commons or the Nauru River Valley. You want to show that you have new problems. So the thing that's perverse about the proposals, by and large, of people who are sincere about environmental issues is that most of them want to create these large bureaucracies to manage resources, and they're creating the very institutions, and they're holding the resources in the very way, i.e. in this common status, that is inevitable to create environmental problems. So when you look at water pollution or air pollution or hazardous substances or wildlife preservation or you name it, you have the same problem. If you think about where all the environmental problems are, they're all on commons. They're in the air, they're the roadside, they're the lake, the river, the ocean, etc.
Right, but we can't privatize the lakes and the air and the rivers, though, can we?
Yes, you can. In fact, you can compare lakes and rivers that actually are owned privately to ones that are not. And you'll find that the river that is owned privately doesn't have these problems, because the river owners, let's say a factory is on the side of a river, and there's a group of people who own the thoroughfare of this river. If the factory dumps waste into the river, then the people on the river have recourse to go after the factory for essentially a trespass.
Well, but what if the factory itself buys the river? Then they can dump whatever they want in it, though.
They could, but the problem is that people downstream would then have a right to then sue the factory for polluting their water. The interesting thing about this subject is that there's a great tradition of this issue in the common law. In the common law, the Anglo-American tradition of the common law, these kinds of disputes were not unknown. In other words, if you and I live next door to each other, and I built a fire, and the fire was spewing out all sorts of fumes, and they invaded your house, in the common law, you had a right to come to me and get redress for my trespass, or worse, on you and your property. What happened historically, though, was that the king in England and other places decided that the smoke that was billowing out was a public good as long as it meant supporting expanding the coal industry. So literally what happened in the 19th century in England was they changed the law so that it was legal to essentially have smoke coming out of chimneys and out of factories that polluted the air, because the king decided it was in the public interest to have this smoke because it would support the coal industry. And not too surprisingly, if you go back and see what happened, how that came into being, it turns out the coal interests lobbied the king to use the king's power essentially to disregard the property rights of the people. And that's why London became so polluted. And you find this over and over again in the history of not just environmental policy, but most regulatory policies. So there's a lot more to the story about the environment than may seem on face value. And if you go to the most extreme versions of collectivism, say in the Soviet Union or in Eastern Europe and other places, you'll find the most utterly polluted areas. I mean, vast fields in Hungary and other places were totally destroyed because they were polluted by lead poisoning, and they were just dumped by the government because there was no recourse. And so when people are serious-minded, and properly so, about dealing with these environmental problems, this is what needs to be done. Another simple example would be some of the most polluted areas in the United States are military bases. And the military has long had a special exemption from being responsible for polluting ground aquifers, polluting the land, polluting the air from its operations. Why?
So if because they have an exemption from the EPA, then you can't go ahead and sue them.
That's right. But it's even worse than that, because it's not just that the Army, say, could pollute the ground aquifer and get away with it, but the EPA, even if the EPA was created to monitor the Army, the EPA itself is not responsible. In other words, let's say the EPA makes a mistake. Well, what happens is that no EPA bureaucrat can be held accountable because there's sovereign immunity. One of the great case studies about this is the story of Love Canal, which is a very famous story that many people have heard something about or know more about. Love Canal was in New York State, in the Buffalo area. It was a canal built that was done by private firms. What happened was that, to make the story short, the company Hooker Chemical embedded in the ground some chemical wastes that it had no further use for, essentially. And the technology they used to contain the waste was exactly the technology that engineers accepted was correct to make sure this would not go into groundwater. So the local school district, through eminent domain, took over this area. And they were then warned by Hooker Chemical in the process. In other words, by eminent domain, meaning they forcibly took the land from the property owners, and the property owners were forced to sell to the school district at under market rates. So the school district gets the property, and the Hooker Canal, in the terms of the eminent domain, told the school district not to cut into this buried chemical waste containment site. But the school district did anyway. They cut right through the middle of it, and the chemical waste were leaking out into the groundwater. The school district then sold part of the land, and a subdivision was built, and schools were built, which is why they took over it in the first place. So over time, the chemicals were leaching out into the groundwater, and people living in this development started feeling funny. There's controversy over exactly what caused different health problems, but the point is that there's evidence that some people had ill effects. Okay, so those people then discover that there was this leaching chemical containment situation that's leaking into the aquifer. All right, so they would logically want to get damages from the people responsible. So they go to the school district. The school district says, we're not responsible because we're a public entity. We're above the law, and nobody who works for the school district can be held accountable. So who do they go to? They go to Hooker Chemical, who, of course, contained it properly. But because Hooker Chemical is considered to be a deep pocket source, they then sued Hooker Chemical, and Hooker Chemical was then held criminally liable for these health problems.
So they could prove that they had warned the school district in advance.
That's right, even though they could prove it. And so that's the irony of the orthodox view in most environmental organizations, is that the solution to the problem is to socialize and bureaucratize these different things. And it's true with forest lands, it's true with almost all different kinds of areas. And the irony is that the only way to solve these problems is through defining property rights and enforcing rights among parties so that people cannot be harmed and damaged by others.
Okay, so how do you take that same philosophy and apply it to healthcare and education?
Well, in healthcare, of course, the government is the 800-pound gorilla in the healthcare field. It dominates finance through Medicare, through many other kinds of things. The regulations that affect hospitals and drug companies through the FDA and everything in healthcare is just unbelievable. I mean, it's huge. It's like a regulated utility in some respects. So let's pick one part of it. Let's pick the cost of drugs, all right, which is a big issue right now. The cost of pharmaceuticals. Well, all pharmaceuticals are approved and only can be approved for sale in the United States if they're approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. So the process to be approved takes 10, 12, or more years to go through this approval process. As a result, the cost of getting any one drug approved is something in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So what does that mean? That means that if you are a small firm, let's say that you are a proverbial firm in your garage, and you've discovered some new something or other that can stop some ailment, you have to go through this whole process. You've got to raise hundreds of millions of dollars just to get the drug approved. All right? So that means that most people and most companies are eliminated from the marketplace entirely. Only big, big companies can exist. The second thing that happens is that the approval process is such that since it costs so much to get these drugs approved, in the research that goes into developing these drugs, what scientists find is they find out that some particular drug taken from a leaf in Brazil or wherever the source might be, it may be a synthetic drug, has a particular use for certain kinds of ailments that may affect, say, 50,000 people in the United States, or 10,000 people, or 100,000 people, as opposed to 50 million people, right? But the problem is that the cost is so high to develop these drugs that have a more narrow market, which is most drugs, by the way, the companies will not go through the process to get them approved by the FDA. It's not worth it. They will only propose those drugs that have a big universe of customers. So most drugs that are discovered in research never even are applied to the FDA for approval, and these are called orphan drugs.
Well, and I think probably most, I shouldn't say that, but many people would say, well, that's the problem with them being capitalists, is they only want to develop the drugs that make them money, and if they can only save a few thousand people, then it's not worth it.
Well, the fact of the matter is that what keeps these capitalists from developing the drugs is this huge cost caused by this government agency. Now, on the other hand, because this agency acts essentially as a barrier, in other words, a cost barrier for firms to get into the market who might have new ideas. You know, one of the things about the high technology field is a lot of the innovation was caused by these small companies. David Packard and Bill Hewlett started in a garage, and there's many different stories about this. But in the biotech field, it's almost impossible to do this. And in the pharmaceutical field, it's almost impossible because of these huge costs to get approval. But large companies like the fact that the FDA causes these high cost barriers to keep out small competitors. They don't want these little competitors out. They want to go through their drug approval process and get their drug approved and not have competition for it. So it's most drug companies where, on the one hand, don't like the fact they have these huge costs caused by the FDA. On the other hand, they like the fact the huge costs exist to keep out competition.
And now solution presented to us in the Congress, I believe, this week, right, or very recently,
right,
is for Congress to now go ahead and pay for the prescription drugs because they're so expensive.
Right. So what that means then is, in fact, it's not just that, but it's also proposing that the patents that are of a drug that's, you know, some firm is researching got approval, should be then essentially you can take, the government agency can take the patent away from the drug company and have the drug produced by others. So what that means is very few companies are then going to want to spend the hundreds of millions of dollars to develop the drug in the first place because they can't even recoup the costs. So what's going to happen is you're going to have far fewer new drugs that are going to be developed because there's no point to it. And so the point of the field of economics, when you study human behavior, is that you're studying incentives that people face. Everybody wants to be better off today and tomorrow and next year than they were now or last year. You want to be happier, you want to be freer, you want to be healthier, you want to be whatever it is. And so the incentives people face are very important. And if you create huge costs and difficulty for them to overcome. Advancing themselves as they see opportunities arise, then you can create problems. And the problem with government control is that instead of many, many people in society using their own individual minds to look at the world, see opportunities, and innovate in their own capacity, you only have a few number of people who run the bureaucracy dictating what those choices should be made. So you have you just don't have the kind of dynamism that you need and creativity as well as information that you need to have a prosperous society. So you essentially it's like throwing a gigantic wet blanket over everybody, and they can't see what's going on, and they can't make choices, and therefore they're constrained. And it's true in education in almost every field. I mean, you have the same basic problem. The particulars are different, but it's not unusual. One of our websites that we have is a website called FDAreview.org. And if anybody's interested in the FDA and this whole issue of drug costs and all that, they're welcome to go there. You'll find all sorts of studies, the history of the FDA, proposals about how to get out from under this problem. And it's not that tough. It's just you have very, very powerful interest groups that want the current system, or they want to socialize it more. And the average person has no idea what's going on.
And the insurance companies fall in that same category with the big pharmaceutical companies.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean, that's right. I mean, any company wants to reduce its risk, its uncertainty for the future. And one way to do that is to shift that to the government. So if you look at the history of government regulation, you'll find that every government regulation is being pushed by two groups of people. One are those people who believe that they're going to do good or some other ideological reason. The other group are the interest groups who personally can profit from it. And economists talk about this in terms of the so-called alliance between bootleggers and Baptists. It's called the Bootlegger-Baptist Alliance. And the idea basically is that prohibition was being pushed both by bootleggers and by Baptists. The Baptists, on the one hand, believed that they were going to help people. They were going to keep people from being drunks and breaking up families and all the rest of it. And by banning alcohol, that was going to be a way to help improve society, improve families. The bootlegger wanted to ban alcohol because they knew that if prohibition existed, the price of alcohol would go through the roof. They then could make a lot more money, and if they could pay off the local police, the government would keep competition out. So you have this unholy alliance, and you have this kind of perspective in all areas of government policy. If you look at who lobbies for these measures, you always have this combination of special interests who profit handsomely from these measures by getting subsidies, by getting government to regulate out of business for competition, and so on and so forth, to shift the burden of cost and risk to the taxpayer, and those people who think that they're helping out or they feel better about themselves because they support it. What the Institute does, essentially, is focuses on bursting that mythology. In other words, we're basically trying to show that the best intentions of people are not good enough if the policies are simply going to be one of cartelizing society, of shifting the burden onto the citizenry and rewarding a few people who are special interests in the process. But virtually every public policy ends up being like that.
I'd like to ask you about the current economic situation. There's all kinds of media attention on the Bush tax cut and supply-side economics and demand-side economics, and I was just wondering where you guys fit on that.
Well, the tax cut that was passed would probably be better called a tax shift. In other words, it is true that certain levels of taxes were cut as far as what people would pay on the taxes, say, on dividends they get from owning stock and so forth. However, at the same time, the Bush administration and the Congress is spending money so that the deficit this year will be the record deficit that the federal government has ever had, $400 billion. So what that means is that taxpayers are indebted to pay off this debt in the future. So the shift of the burden of taxes is essentially being shifted from now to the future, which means either people currently paying taxes will have to pay higher taxes in the future, or their children will have to. So the tax is really a tax shift. Now, this is not to say that in the future the government couldn't conceivably cut its spending and cover this loss, but the track record of the government is not to do that, right? Government continues to grow, and of course, as I mentioned before, these crises, and the current crisis that is causing all the huge growth in government is this terrorist war crisis. So you have this huge expansion of government spending. I mean, for example, the war in Iraq cost something around $100 billion or more. The occupation is going to cost at least that. And that's not even included in the current budget. The defense spending has gone up by, I forget that percentage increase, but it's been huge. It's gone up like maybe a third. The rate of government spending, the federal level of spending under Bush, is twice the increase it was under Clinton. It's the largest and the fastest increase in government spending since Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson, of course, had the Vietnam War and his so-called Great Society. So the Republicans who control the White House, as well as the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, are showing that they cannot be depended upon to cut spending, even though they claim that they're the party of small government. When it comes down to it, the interest groups that want to get goodies will get as much help from the Republicans as they will from the Democrats. So the lesson of this is that the only way to solve this problem is the public has to understand the nature of public policy, nature of government, nature of politics. That if some politicians propose some program, you've got to understand why he's proposing that program. Why is she proposing that program? It's not because she or he understands that there's some big problem in society and they've magically come up with some solution because these people are angels. It's because they're representing interest groups. And the interest groups want to use government at that moment to line their pockets. And when people begin to understand that that's the nature of it, and that's why Jefferson and Madison and the other founders wanted to radically constrain the power of the central government, then people will not be bamboozled by all this nonsense.
They wanted to limit it at the same time they were expanding it by multiples of times.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back at the history of the growth of the federal government, it's true of the state governments, but not as much because the state governments don't go to war. But they have their own little crises. But the federal government's major increases in power have occurred primarily at wartime, meaning the first huge increase was at the Civil War. Then you have the Spanish-American War. There was the Mexican War, but it wasn't quite as big. Then World War I. Then you had the Great Depression. Then you had World War II and the Cold War and now the Terrorist War. And each of these different episodes, people will say, well, look what we did during the Cold War. Look what we did during World War II. So Ashcroft says, during World War II, we incarcerated people without charge and trial. We intercepted people's communication. We seized bank accounts. We did all these different things. So we have a new war, so it's okay. Well, the Constitution doesn't say that. But the idea is that this crisis mongering gives legitimacy, allegedly, to the idea of accreting these powers. And the average person who's too busy with their life and their family and their work doesn't know what to make of it. They don't understand. And most people don't have a knowledge of the economics of this, or the history of it, to be able to make a difference. So that's what the Institute is involved in doing. The Institute is involved in bridging that gap of lack of understanding. And fortunately, today because of the new technologies, that you can communicate this information far faster and far more extensively than you could, you know, years ago. For example, during the Vietnam War period, it took many, many years for any sort of anti-war movement to develop because it was very costly for people to get to know one another, to communicate information, to make the case against the war, and for people to identify with it. In the build-up to the Iraq War, it took within a matter of months, and you had a worldwide movement. The other thing that's different today is that most people have a rather healthy cynicism or skepticism about politics, politicians, centralized power, and so on. And so, although most people still are being, I think, misled by the claims that politicians make, there is more skepticism. And I think now, I mean, with the aftermath of this Iraqi war, Americans continue to be killed in Iraq. The chaos continues on and on. Since the claim about weapons of mass destruction is clearly being seen at best an intelligence failure, or at worst, a clear deception on the part of people who are trying to mislead Americans in the world. And people are beginning to wonder, you know, I was supporting that war, but what's the story? When am I going to get the truth about this? So here Congress tries to propose having an investigation about this issue of weapons of mass destruction, and the White House is against it. So when people see that, they hopefully will be motivated to look deeper, and you can go to the Internet, you can go to our website and go to other places and get information that hopefully will enable them to make better choices.
So the Independent Institute basically took the anti-war stance throughout this whole last thing, right?
From the very first day, we started raising questions about what was the basis for the war, why was America attacked, why were people in America attacked, who were the people attacking, what was the background of U.S. policies that may have led to this, what kind of response would be appropriate, and we just started doing all sorts of different studies and articles and events based on that. And the administration in Washington didn't want this kind of debate. In fact, to them, anybody who would raise questions was branded as unpatriotic or something. And so, like most rulers, they didn't want to have any dissent or any sort of debate. They wanted to simply issue their rules and people would blindly follow. Well, to some extent, that is what happened. But also, a lot of people were sufficiently dubious about the claim, so they just didn't know, and they wanted to find out where a lot of stuff just didn't make sense. And I think that that lesson is becoming more and more perceived, and I think that's what come out of it. I'll just give you one little example. In the first Gulf War, which was in 1991, there was a number of incidents that occurred that were used to justify the war then after Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. The two arguments that were used at that time was that a woman testified in Congress who claimed to be a nurse, and she claimed that the Iraqi soldiers in Kuwait City were going into orphanages, taking infants out of incubators and putting them on the cold floor to die and killing them. She then testified before Congress about this. It was on all the news media. President Bush Sr. talked about this many times. She then went to the UN and also testified with a physician who was corroborating her report about this genocide of these infants in Kuwait City. And the whole point was that Saddam Hussein was this tyrant and bloodthirsty killer.
And that really was the argument that turned every editorial page in America, too, wasn't
right.
it?
But we later found out that this woman was the daughter of a Kuwaiti ambassador. She was not a nurse. that the whole campaign was organized by the Kuwaiti government, who hired the firm Hill & Knowlton for millions of dollars to do this big campaign. That there was no evidence of Iraqi soldiers even going into the orphanages. There was no evidence of any babies dying. The physician who was brought in turned out to be a dentist who had nothing to do with the orphanage. And the whole thing was contrived. To this day...
Is there proof, sir, that Mr. Bush knew that at the time?
There's a book, the best book on the subject is called The Second Front, written by John MacArthur from the University of California Press, and it goes through all this. The second part of this argument was that Saddam Hussein had amassed massive forces, his entire war machine, on the border of Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and was about to invade and conquer Saudi Arabia. And we couldn't let that happen because Iraq would take over Saudi Arabia, he'd control most of the world's oil, and that would be a calamity. So there is testimony again about this. The White House showed satellite photos that claimed to show Iraqi forces amassed along the Iraqi border, ready and poised to invade Saudi Arabia. So some reporters decided to double check on it. So they independently hired a satellite surveillance firm in, I believe it was either France or in Russia, to take satellite photos, get the satellite photos of the exact same day that the U.S. had its satellite photos, of the same locations. They got the photos, and there were absolutely no forces lined up. There were no forces anywhere in the area. The only newspaper in the U.S. that reported this was the St. Petersburg Times. None of the other papers would touch it. This was also brought up to President Bush. It was brought up to Colin Powell, and they would not answer it. So John MacArthur, in his book Second Front, details all this and many other things about this. And the point was that, like most of these war episodes, you have this propaganda campaign, which is, there's an old saying called, truth is the first casualty of war. And the first Gulf War is a great example of that. One other little side aspect of that particular time was that before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, he contacted the U.S. ambassador to Kuwait, to Kuwait, and asked her whether the U.S. would have any problem if Kuwait were to invade and reseize, as it was claiming, these oil fields. Now, the claim the Iraqis have had was that Kuwait should be part of Iraq. It was essentially taken from Iraq many, many years ago, and that the Iraqis, in their oil exploration, were drilling and using segments of their pipes going not just down into the Kuwaiti fields, but diagonally into Iraq, into Iraqi fields. And the Kuwaitis refused to respond to Iraqi complaints about this. So Saddam Hussein contacted the U.S., asked if there was any problem in their invading Kuwait about this, and the ambassador said, we don't have any opinion about it. So Saddam Hussein read that as a green light, invaded Kuwait, and the rest is history.
Do we have proof that she was instructed by Washington to say that, or was that just her mistake?
We don't know. All we know is that that's what happened, and it's all documented, and she admits it, and so, but anyway, the point of all this is that, like in most of these instances, the public is scared into believing there's an imminent threat, that the government's going to solve the problem, and usually the facts are distorted or misrepresented, and then after the fact, you know, after the crisis passes, then the government goes on its merry way. So, one of the things that's happening now is I think there's the beginning of a catch-up, you might say. In other words, what goes around comes around. And so the government claimed there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq there are no weapons of mass destruction, at least with no weapons of mass destruction that could be used against Americans in the United States or in Israel or other countries. Therefore, the view that there was an imminent threat requiring an invasion where Americans were killed and something around 4,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed is not very defendable. Now, if their reason to invade Iraq was because they feared that Saddam Hussein had torture chambers and had mass graves and so on and so forth, that's what they should have said. But they didn't. That was not their major reason. And
isn't it just a matter of timing that if they can get away with a lie for a day or a week, that's all they need? And if you and I sit here and talk about how they lied their way into the first Gulf War 12 years ago, then so what? They don't care that we know the truth about that now. It only matters that we believe it at the time. And then, I mean, even now this debate about can't find any weapons of mass destruction. Who cares? It was called Operation Iraqi Freedom. Don't you know, we were there to save those people from the tyrant, and that's what matters now. And who cares about weapons of mass destruction?
Well, there's a certain amount of truth to that. A lot of people forget, and they don't pay attention. But I think that it's a little bit different this time. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that if the administration had said that they were there to only liberate Iraqis from a tyrant, blanket and blank, it'd be a different story. But that was a far second or third or fourth reason that they had. So a lot of people in other countries, a lot of the media, a lot of opinion leaders, a lot of members of Congress, Senator Robert Byrd has given two very eloquent speeches about this issue. And you're finding it's being editorialized and in columns and newspapers and everywhere. So there's a credibility gap. Now, if people don't learn the lesson, then the government can do it again. But I think there is a better chance this time that people will begin to see that the emperor is simply not wearing clothes. That's what it comes down to.
The more you tighten your grip, the more people slip through your fingers.
Well, in other words, the Vietnam War ended essentially because American public opinion turned against it, but it took years. The result of that is that Americans had less trust in the government going to war. When Richard Nixon was forced to resign as president, the image of the president as this great, noble, honest, benevolent figure was enormously trashed. And people didn't trust politicians the way they once did, especially the presidency. If it turns out that George W. Bush and his staff lied to the American people, and that if the Iraq situation gets worse, but even if it just stays the same, and some of these distortions and lies become well known, it's going to seriously undercut the ability of the Bush administration to lie again and get away with it, because people are going to doubt whatever they say.
Well, what if they just replace him with a Democrat next time? Won't he be able to get away with it?
Maybe. That's very possible, and that's partly what happened. I mean, it took years for the it seriously hurt the Republican Party after Watergate, and it took years for the Republicans to recover, but it was difficult for the U.S. to launch wars. It was very, very difficult for them to do it. And those who were advocating more wars, you know, would describe this as so-called Vietnam syndrome, that they couldn't launch these wars indiscriminately because the American people would not stand for it.
Boy, and didn't they all sing the song after September 11th that finally Vietnam syndrome is over and we can get back to business?
That's right, exactly. But it's in the United States, there have been two theories or paradigms about who've been dominant in how the U.S. should conduct its foreign affairs. Now, the original paradigm that existed was the paradigm that Jefferson and Washington and others had, was that the U.S. should be neutral. It should be a neutral party. It should not have alliances with other governments. It should trade. You know, the U.S. citizens should be free to trade with any country, but there should be alliances with none, and we should not get involved in foreign wars. And that lasted for most of America's history. However, in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War, which was created by McKinley, essentially, and then getting into World War I, Woodrow Wilson essentially had this other view, which became the orthodox view in the United States that the U.S. should intervene in other countries to spread democracy. And the World War One was supposed to be this war that was going to end all wars, and of course it didn't. It led directly to World War Two, and then World War Two led to other wars. And so the Wilsonian view was the dominant paradigm of Lyndon Johnson, of Truman, of, you know, most Democrats and Republicans. It was the view that Eisenhower had, that Reagan had. Since the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, another theory came into being, which was the view of the neoconservatives. And the view of the neoconservatives was that the Wilsonian approach was correct, but not aggressive enough. We should be intervening in countries more aggressively. We should do it unilaterally. We should do it preemptively. Even if a country doesn't have weapons of mass destruction, if they might develop it, we have the right to bomb them. So the Bush administration, essentially, foreign affairs is essentially controlled by this group of neoconservatives. And they believe it's okay to have a war in countries all over the world. And that's their agenda. And that's what they've been pushing. And this is no mystery. They've been writing about this for 10 or more years. There have been many articles now that are exposing the reality of what's being done. We already know now that people like Paul Wolfowitz and others wanted to invade Iraq many, many years ago. I mean, that 9/11 was not the reason for it. They wanted to invade Iraq because they wanted to take over the Mideast. And so when people begin to see this, it definitely, I think, colors the image of the claim that the Bush administration or others have about intervening. In other words, taxing Americans to send people into other countries to kill people, overthrow regimes, good or bad, and occupy those countries and take over whatever exists. And so it's not exactly in keeping with the American tradition. It's exactly what the founders fought a revolution against. They fought a revolution against an empire, the British Empire, who believed in those policies. So the table has turned.
You're trying to show, after the neoconservative disaster, that really the Wilsonians are really no better than them, and we need to get back to the original alternative, which is leave the world alone.
Right. In other words, I mean, the reason why Sweden and Switzerland and most countries aren't at war is because they don't intervene in other countries. And one of the great lessons of history is that if you want peaceful relations among people, different people, you want to encourage free trade among them, because free trade means that they get to know one another, they exchange ideas and products and technologies, they develop tolerance among the different groups, they also become interdependent. So you're less likely to shoot somebody who's producing the grain you need to make your bread with. So there's an old view that free trade leads to peace, and at the same time there's a view that says where people and goods don't cross borders or are prevented from crossing borders, armies will. And that is exactly what you don't want. Americans don't want armies invading the U.S., right?
Absolutely not.
Right. Okay, well then you can't then say that you have a right to invade other countries, because it's not a principle that people are going to see as some sort of universal, meaningful right, because it doesn't make any sense.
Mr. Thoreau, thank you. That's time, so I got to let it go at that. This has
been
David J. Thoreau, founder and president of the Independent Institute, and you can be reached. What's your website?
It's independent.org.
Thank you very much for this hour, sir. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you.